It was just smoke and mirrors and a facade. And I was so disheartened to see my name next to work that I had tried to do, that I was not allowed to do, that had been reported to funders as if they had done it, which again speaks to this larger experience of Neighborhood House having mismanaged funds for 3 years with zero deliverables before Zach and I became employees and contracted and actually had deliverables.
This is the Bris Poinsett Show. This is the Bris Poinsett Show. Though the world's most dangerous infomercial, I'm your host, Bris Poinsett. Along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. This is the best of the Bris Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bris Poinsett, and along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. You can also catch clips on youtube.com/Bris Poinsett, plus exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/Bris Poinsett. Make sure to follow us on twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's numbers with a Z, or the Numbers Podcast Network on the Numbers podcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a Z, or wherever you get your podcasts. Help support this channel and get early access to videos plus exclusive content and patrons only live discussions by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bris Poinsett. This is the Bris Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. And today we have a special, potentially recurring segment, Tales from the Nonprofit Industrial Complex, where we look at a recent incident with, well, series of incidents with Neighborhood House. Specifically, I speak with Amber Boydston and Zach Galehouse about their firings from working with the organization and attempts to, you know, do work to serve the community. Many of us who do work around nonprofits, the nonprofit industrial complex, we have trauma from some of the stuff that happens behind the scenes, and it's an interesting mix of both power and resources and, you know, where sometimes good intentions just aren't enough. And what does it look like when people, you know, work with organizations that have access to the resources, have access to, you know, the donors and the people with said resources in the city, in the state? And what does it look like to try and merge those things? Also, what does it look like in cases where it almost feels like nonprofits chew up and spit out a lot of community leaders who are trying to do the right thing? So we talk about all that. And it's very revealing conversation, but also, again, very informative. Check it out. Hey, we're back. Amber, Zach, thank you for taking the time to talk with me this morning before we kind of get into everything. How are you all doing?
Good morning. Thank you for having us, Bruce.
Good morning.
Yeah, so today we're, you know, we're here under not the greatest of circumstances, but very important to talk about in this nonprofit industrial complex world, you know, talking about what happens and, you know, what gets in the way of serving the community. I think this is just a very important issue to talk about. But before we get into just all the details, you just kind of talk a little bit, give people a little bit of a background on your work and how you got connected with Neighborhood House.
Yes. So actually there was a white woman who works in the community and has worked for the city who followed my organization's Instagram page for content. And she invited me to support Neighborhood House contractually, as an individual, so not as my organization, which is Spirit of Justice, but just as myself, Amber, to support Neighborhood House developing a parent education programs and support systems for the community through county funds. And so that was early in the summer of 2022. And I contracted for a few months before becoming a Neighborhood House county employee.
And yeah, I started right after Amber. I came on for the project because the piece of the whole project was building out a website that would be like the hub for all of these services available in the county, as well as the programming we were going to do. But as I went through the typical stages of what website build, and I'm a strategist, goes into, I realized that there was no kind of like meat or like content that was like actually being put out. So I kind of started focusing more of my efforts on working closely with Amber to develop all of the things that would actually like make a website even necessary. And so that was how I kind of got looped in and late in the summer too, and how that kind of my role continued to morph as we realized there were a lot more holes than big buckets of content and things that were already happening.
Okay, so just to rewrite that point, so you two came in separately into Neighborhood House. Had you two just been familiar with each other before that, or?
No, it was our first time meeting.
Yeah, I had followed Amber's org and things in that nature, but we had not directly like worked together or anything like that.
And it was a saving grace for me because it had been so challenging to collaborate with the existing team that I was a part of. And in our very first recorded meeting, I emailed Zach while we were on our Zoom. And I was like, may we speak afterwards? Because I just was looking for anyone who could collaborate and really support on foundational levels. And it was clear that they were someone who could and have proven sense.
Yeah. All right. That's good to hear in terms of, it can always be hard out here as far as just like, we are so isolated in this work, and as we'll get to talking about in a minute, there's a lot of things that, you know, just make trust hard out here. So with that said, Amber, can you just talk about what was the agreement with Neighborhood House in terms of what were the services you were, you know, at least tasked with providing to the community, and what, you know, what was their end of the deal?
So I was hired to support funneling county funds specifically into Multnomah County with our families of the global majority, Black, Brown, and Indigenous families, supporting really building a cohort of parents who could help both inform as they had a pulse on what was happening in their neighborhoods, so inform where maybe we could funnel resources, in addition to support creating the events and experiences and education that would have the most impact with those communities. So my title was network facilitator, and I supported facilitating all staff meetings, education from an equity lens, and really used a lot of my mediation skills throughout my 9 months at Neighborhood House.
And I would just add into there, like, I think one of the things that we liked coming onto it was that there were some guides, but it was really like, do what's best for the community, do what's best for, we were kind of given this perception of free reign to kind of come after this. And like me working on the website with pulling together partners, and Amber like bringing in those partners. But we were originally tasked with kind of like putting together like a proven archaic model of like leadership councils with like advisory councils and just all these like overseeing kind of bodies. And we kind of did our best to not only break that down, but also like redefine what parenting education was, like redefine it as like not just these courses, but also like Maslow's hierarchy of like food and housing and all these other things. And so as we started working, I think that's why we connected so well, because we were like, oh yeah, we should be taking this much more like radical approach to this. We should be breaking down these like hierarchies and barriers that like actually prevent getting resources and real help to the community. And so like that was like the start of all of this, which was really exciting. And then it quickly became evident that that was not the case.
Yeah, and I know there's also, I know Oregon State University was another partner, but you also were working with a number of community organizations on this, correct?
Correct. So Oregon State University supported the Oregon Parent Education Community Fund, so the OPEC fund. And that fund really had three streams of large amounts of funding that were supposed to go into the community. One of the partnerships was OCF, who has, I think they're a $3.7 billion county community
private family fund,
private family fund
foundation.
So Zach and I really supported building a concrete map and plan of what parent education with a community focus could look like over a year to 5 years. We created a work plan for OSU and for OPEC and for Neighborhood House, really with explicit ways that we could support the community in real time. And we built relationships with county and community organizations and individuals over the 9 months so that we could be funneling funds in spaces where we knew we're going to have the largest amount of impact. Some larger organizations that people might know of, like Equitable Giving Circle or Youth with Miss Imani Muhammad, maybe some smaller ones as well, Tenacious Rose with Linnea, and so on and so forth. So Zach and I spent, you know, a bulk of our time really trying to both build community relationships and then hold events for the community where we could give back in real time.
Yeah, and that, you know, sounds like something where everyone would win, theoretically. So then the question becomes, so when did things start breaking down and what happened?
In early September of 2022, I was asked to hold a 20-minute trauma-informed speech with 250 of our primarily white private donors for Neighborhood House, as Neighborhood House, prior to me being hired, had purchased a large building that they were planning to convert into, to expand their pantry, their food pantry, and then also convert a portion of it into senior housing. And so I was asked to hold this speech, and in having a conversation about how they actually acquired this space that the private donors had funded and would be seeing for the first time the fruits of their year-long worth of donations. It was pretty clear that there was no trauma-informed lens that was used. And so I was in conversation with a white woman, Mari Yerger, multiple times, and was asked to provide this speech as an employee, and went back and forth for the better part of 3 weeks with Mari in conversation about really what trauma-informed lens was and how best to show up and support both, you know, an image of Neighborhood House, because this would be the one time a year that they were all meeting in person, in addition to keeping my integrity. And through our back and forth, which took place via email and phone over 40 times, I let Mari know that I needed a level of transparency that I wasn't receiving in order for me to be able to deliver this 20-minute speech. And that I felt very much like I was in a House Negro position, and I'm being asked to uphold values and a mission statements that really are not aligned with their praxis. And flash forward to the actual donor supper, where I showed up and immediately was met by a community of elderly white people who were really emboldened in their positions of power. And I didn't know anybody there other than my boss at the time, Mira, who showed up later and who's Indian. And I was in a crowd of 250 people, and one white woman came up to me, and this is before I had seen Mari, although unbeknownst to me, she was in the crowd in this circle of elderly white women and waiting to find out when I give my speech, all of this. And this elderly white woman goes to touch my hair, and I moved away. And as I moved back forward, my braids swung forward, and she grabbed my braids and she said, is this real? And referring to my hair. And then she said, I like your chocolate skin, but I like his chocolate skin more. How did you two get here together? And I didn't know what she was talking about. And so I turned around, and behind me, there was a richly melanated gentleman that I'd never met before. He had heard what this white woman had said. And we were both quiet for a moment. And I said, well, my name's Amber. I'm the network facilitator. And he said, my name's Kevin. I'm the new CFO. I was just hired last week. So that was my first little bit. I went that, you know, that it was a little bit of a radicalizing moment throughout that next, you know, couple of hours at that donor supper. There were many directly inappropriate, racist, really, statements that were made. And I ended up giving my speech late because there was a white man who spoke about 40 minutes longer on his speech. And so I gave my speech in the rain as people left the supper. And that was really, I think, the laid a good foundation for me of the kind of experience I was going to have for the remaining time there. But yes, it was a typical Oregon experience, Bruce.
And I think it was like the instance too of like asking for like this trauma informed and community centered work after the fact. Like, and I think that happens a lot here where like people in orgs just do whatever it is they want to do. And then later they're like, oh, how do we fix the optics on this? Or how do we like layer in all this language to justify this shitty decision? Or like, I don't know, like it was just very much that. And I think that has kind of run its course throughout the whole rest of our experience as well.
Yeah, yikes.
All talk, no substance or whatever.
So you're invited to give a speech to 250 mostly older white people about, you know, this trauma-informed work. First thing, someone really grabbing your braids, talking about, I like your chocolate skin, but I like his chocolate skin. Like, wow. I think we all have our own wild, traumatic experiences, especially like in these nonprofit spaces. And kind of Zach, to the point you were just making, I think some of that also, just because, again, we have so many nonprofits in Portland and Oregon, and it kind of feels like this, for lack of better terms, like wild, wild west space where a lot of people, either because of like, I'll say, again, for lack of better terms, lack of regulations, but then also if you're doing something for, you know, seemingly a good cause, people will like, you know, look away from other things. So it feels like a lot. I mean, this just sounds like a case study and, you know, what goes on behind the scenes. But yeah, just to go from there, because, you know, offline, you are actually, let me back that up a minute. So, you know, that was a starting experience, but then also I do want to kind of like get into some of these other, you again said offline, talk about some, just some other very wild stories, but getting to the, as to like the task and, you know, again, like serving the community. I know like there's been some roadblocks in just being able to provide things, to do activities. Can you just talk about, you know, sure, what that's been like and what's kind of happened there?
Mm-hmm. So we, you know, the donor supper ended end of September. The event took place. And then October, Zach and I and a handful of other community organizations supported a Family Fall Festival. And so the whole idea was really twofold, that we were trying to engage families and communities, because Neighborhood House didn't and doesn't have a presence in Multnomah County. And so we're trying to build and cultivate one, and to build trust in the community, that we can't just ask the community of labor or to show up at events if they don't know who we are. So we decided to have an event where we could ask community what they wanted in a survey form of whatever way worked well for them, whether talking to us or filling out an actual form, in addition to providing free food and resources. And so we partnered with community that we both wanted and had a part of our parent council that we were building, in addition to communities that could actually support parent education in some form. And so we held this beautiful event at Irving Park in Northeast Portland, and fed close to 5,000 families. So we had one person that works in our community Tuesday, who historically supports feeding our houseless community. He brought his mother in to cook food. And then we had a handful of 13 different vendors that also were really engaged in community. We had some schools showed up. Jefferson School showed up to support. And that event took place. And in our messaging of that event on our flyer, we were really clear that we wanted to feed families of the global majority for free. And Mari received that flyer and sent it out to funders. And I think without reviewing it, because she came back later quite upset about the language that was used, that we were feeding essentially Black and Brown and Indigenous families for free, and had a lot of questions around why we would use that language, asked if we would change the language, and said that she actually wouldn't put up the flyer in any spaces until we changed that language. And it was reflective, again, of the types of values that Neighborhood House really has, and that we are trying to build spaces and support the most marginalized communities, which we know are not white Ukrainian refugees. They're Black and Brown and Indigenous people, and Black and Brown and Indigenous refugees. And that we couldn't even market in a way that invited them into the space. And so we ended up having multiple flyers, and Zach and I did not change our messaging on our flyer at all. We actually told Mari if she wanted it changed, she'd have to do that herself, because we didn't ask that flyer go out to anybody in the Neighborhood House community. We just sent it to her because she had requested it. We had We Out Here magazine and Brick Studios there to take pictures of the entire event, because again, Zach was building a website and we were hoping to have real images of real community on the website, and real partners that we were going to be working with reflected on our website. And Mari sent an email to me stating that she knew that we needed to have a conversation about previous harm that had taken place. But prior to that conversation, she needed Zach and I to release images of, you know, essentially Black and Brown community, because there was another funding event coming up.
And all those requests were for like Neighborhood House specific, like internal org things around like a newsletter update, like things that they'd been doing, and they needed all that info from us. Without addressing any of the issues that had already come up, without even getting to larger issues that came later. I also think like in doing that event, it just shows, and I don't know if this is like a Portland specific thing or just like it happens everywhere, but I think it's like when trying to do these like while trying to like actually push through like the integrity of being inclusive, it makes white people feel excluded versus like more people just being included. And so we constantly felt that, where like all we were trying to do at the basis of what we're working on is center like Black and Indigenous and like other BIPOC community. And it was making all of these like white people and this org that centers on wanting to like help everyone, but that everyone means like white people at the center. And like, they couldn't even get past like basic things. If I made that flyer and all it said was like free food, free like family portraits, because we had a photographer there, and it was just like everything's free for BIPOC specifically, but like we weren't charging anything for the event, but we wanted to make sure in the language of how we advertised it that like BIPOC families knew like this was for them, this is your guys' thing. And they could not get over it. They even sent a retraction to the newsletter they sent out, being like, oh, there is a mistake, this isn't what it should have said. They put so much more effort into kind of like wanting to fix that image piece of it than actually like looking into what the larger issue was.
Wow.
The event was a success, Bruce. It was beautiful. Lots of people were fed, families showed up. We got great images for a potential website.
Tenacious Rose brought a bunch of, it was around Halloween, so we were doing this like free Halloween like costume exchange and pickup and things like that. There were a bunch of like, it was very the free food, we ended up being able to like redistribute it to like houseless community, all the leftover food. Like there were a lot of really cool things that happened, but that was lost on our employers, I guess.
So, you know, you have an example there. One of what sounds like just trying to censor really just your messaging to the community, and again, hampering one of the activities you've been tasked to do. But can you just talk about, like, there have been other examples, whether it be, you know, them trying to, I guess, push back on certain, you know, like specifically like culturally specific type events, but then also I'm just curious as far as like, are payments going in on time? Because usually that thing kind of, these things go hand in hand with these organizations. So got to ask.
Payments aren't happening in real time. And mind you, we're also planning future events. So this is mid fall, October, you know, mid October, we're planning winter events. We're planning into next year, because again, we are specifically funneling culturally specific funds into the community, which have these deliverables that are attached to OPEC, these evidence-based classes and series that I'm tasked as Amber, the network facilitator, and taking and then decolonizing and pairing with culturally specific programs. So all of this is happening in real time. Photographer does not get paid in real time. Our parent council members also are not getting paid in ways that are working for them. We have this antiquated system where we have to either have an assistant of our boss go to a Safeway and get, you know, card $25, $75 incremental cards. Sorry, I can't even think of the language for it. And then to pay our parents that are actually supporting building this hub. So no, payments are not going through. Zach and I planned a free Black Panther Wakanda viewing at a movie theater that historically serves just white community in downtown Portland. And we went to this theater specifically again to provide an opportunity for families to come together in just a relaxed and ease-filled way. In November, and the credit cards bounced when Zach and I went to pay at the end of the night, which was incredibly embarrassing amongst a sea of Black faces and families who we had just fed, and then met with all white living room theater staff. So just within the next 3 weeks, there were just an unfolding avalanche of trauma that continued.
Yeah. And I think, Bruce, you touched on this earlier. I think it's like this playground within the nonprofit. Like, it's the Wild West, but it's like, it's Wild West. However, if it's for Black and Brown people, we will make up every possible made up process and regulation and thing to make sure that it's harder. But if it's not, we don't care. Do whatever you want. Again, Wild West, if you're white, or doing like falling in line and doing what's said. And like, we weren't even going that far outside of anything at that point. It was just really confusing to us of like, we're doing the things that are being told, but it was like, that's not really how things had been done up until that point. And that's not really what the actual goal seemed to be.
Yeah. Wow. Just talking about that, the living room experience. And we kind of talked about how it's hard to just build trust earlier doing community work. So like, I can only imagine that's, you know, maybe I'm just embarrassing. It's just, it makes it harder to do your jobs in the future.
Absolutely. We had had organizations that had shown up as well, just to support. So it wasn't just families, that Black families that were there, it was other Black organizations and their executive directors who were at the end of their day too, you know, who just wanted to kind of chill and enjoy some food and watch, you know, Wakanda, you know, rise again. I don't think that there was an awareness at the level that I would have hoped for in processing the situation with Neighborhood House around how deeply rooted in historical practices of just gatekeeping spaces and having us really just like this level of tokenization that was taking place at the same time. It was like, it was there clearly as a Neighborhood House employee, and then was just still at the very end, like didn't have full access to the space in the way that would have helped everyone feel comfortable and safe. And I personally talk about that a lot as a light-skinned Black person, is like, what does it look like for Black and Brown Indigenous people to create safe spaces for one another? And it was expansive hurt that took place.
I think it's also like a textbook example of the tokenization of like Amber being like, here, you're this Neighborhood House employee, this org's going to benefit from putting your face out there and saying you're with it. However, you get no access to actually all the things that come with being part of this org. And because this org isn't well known enough within the communities we're working in, it all falls back on like, me and Amber have our faces and names out there for everything, right? And so it's this like toxic cycle of like how it grinds down all of these like BIPOC people trying to do this work, and how like the tokenizing, like if you're not doing the full tap dance to what they want you to be doing, like you're fully disregarded and are basically disposable, is like the feeling it got. Because it came up multiple times where we'd have to be like, this is bad just for us. Like, it's going after our own reputations because of the like lacking that we're of support we're getting from the org we're supposed to be working for. And so that again was a trend that continued on for months and months after that as well.
And you, Amber, you were brought in to do trauma-informed work. But I'm curious as far as like what obligation or agreement Neighborhood House had as far as like any kind of like trauma-informed approach on their end, besides just bringing you in.
They didn't. At one point, the HR director asked if I would support writing with our contracted DEI trainer, Kenya, if we would write actually a staff on, like, if we could, they don't even have any sort of onboarding for their staff. And so she asked if I would support writing one from an equity-informed lens, not even like a portion of it, like, write the whole staff handbook. I would say the entirety of the time I was looking and advocating and speaking from an equity informed lens, and the only piece of that that was ever really appreciated at times was when I would speak out in OSU trainings that were recorded. And so I don't know if the accolades were coming my way because it was recorded, or because I was actually educating, which I am, that was my job. That's what I was being paid to do. And then specifically at neighborhood house meetings, they wanted me to just lead them in breath work, which, I mean, if you know me personally, or you know my org, like I'm here for the breath work all day, every day, although it was incredibly disingenuous because that was not really where my skill set could have been best used. And so even in times of tension, I was asked to start our meetings, even with deadlines, even with waiting to advocate for people to get paid who had yet to be paid, ask questions about bounced credit cards and so on and so forth. I would be asked to lead entire staff in meditation. And so, I don't know. When did I use my trauma-informed lens? At all times? When did they accept it? Every once in a while.
And also to that end, you know, just talking about again, doing the job, you know, they were asking you to do they hired you to do, but also, yeah, like we were saying before, just offline, you all mentioned just some other very, lack of better terms, just wild, some wild interactions. Can you just talk about a few of those in terms of, yeah, like, you know, again, I think we all have our own experiences with sort of like the wild stuff, particularly white people say to us in these spaces, but, yeah, can you just talk some more about that?
Bruce, Portland is small. So I was on a Zoom at Neighborhood House, and I had been asked to be a part of our equity committee. And so I said I joined because I was curious what that was comprised of. Before I joined, though, I had a Zoom, and there was a richly melanated Black femme who hopped on, Kenya Budd. And I was like, no way, I know Kenya. Kenya and I, our children had gone to school together, and I had found out that they were contracting as a DEI trainer. And I'm transparent about money because that's a value of mine. And I often think it's something within Black communities that isn't always talked about often enough. Kenya is a richly melanated Black femme. When I shared with her how much I had been making at the time, which when I was contracting for $75 an hour. And then when I started working there was getting paid $31 an hour. Kenya, as the DEI trainer and really architect for, you know, in theory, was supposed to be the architect for all of Neighborhood House, which had been around for 105 years and had not done any DEI work or equity work, was getting paid $20 an hour. And so after my experience at the donor supper and moving into the experience with Mari asking for images, I found out that there was an HR meeting with an ED Chris and then also Mari and Kenya. And I found out that in this confidential HR meeting, Mari had stated that because the issue was, how are we going to pay Amber for this trauma-informed speech that we asked her to give and then invited compensation, which I didn't ask for. They were like, we would just want to provide $500 for your time prior to them trying to change the speech 40 times. And then they were confused if I had given the speech as Amber or I'd given it as my org. Mind you, never once had I done anything under Spirited Justice. And so we get in this back and forth for weeks. While we're in this back and forth for weeks, Mari is in this has this HR meeting with a Chris and Kenya. And she says, Amber knew her position as a house hard ER. So Kenya comes to me to tell me, hey, we had to stop this HR meeting and explain to Mari not only why that wasn't okay, the context in which you had originally said, I feel like I'm in a house Negro position being asked to one, represent neighborhood house in this light, but also tap dance and be used disingenuously. And here are the historical pieces that I'm referencing that are still alive today in your practices. And so they slowed down that HR meeting apparently with Mari, who kept deflecting and saying, you know, the reason why Amber's hair was touched at the donor supper is because these people have issues. And at that time, Kenya and Chris at least expressed to me in November of 2022 that they were trying to have Mari understand that it is an environment that Neighborhood House has cultivated and supported, in which embolden white women mostly, but white people in general, to weaponize a falsehood of power and to also touch Black people and comment on Black people's skin. So that was taking place through November into December, where Mari was still asking for images from me and Zach and from our photographer, Max Smith from We Out Here magazine, at all hours of the day and night, while also acknowledging that there was these key conversations that she needed to have with me about harm that had taken place.
Jesus.
And she still works there, by the way.
I mean, just from a basic standpoint, as far as like, once you have that, like just in any organization, it doesn't matter what you're doing, you don't resolve that, I don't think anyone in their right mind moves forward. But so before we kind of like get into next steps, I mean, just got to ask, you know, we talked about the business effects in terms of like you being able to do your job. We talked about, you know, basically what the community loses out on, you know, when you're not able to do your job. But I just have to ask both of you as far as just like how this has affected you personally, because it's a lot.
I'll just be perfectly honest. I'll say this first. I have a really great community of abolitionists who, you know, both y'all are on here, Bruce, Zach, many other people that I won't name, who have checked in on me, and y'all are the reason why I'm okay. In addition to a few other people, I have really, because of the work that I do, I'll just give a content warning here. I never in my life have had so many suicidal ideations over the last like couple of months, because I've had really, really challenging times, as we all have personally and in our lives. I have two children. I have, you know, the co-parenting, all of that. Like life is real. I'm 39. Like life has been real. But I have never built community relationships and had access to funds and promised the community funds, and community that is in dire need of just the bare, I mean, we all deserve more than the bare minimum, but we are not even getting that in most spaces. And I have never been in a situation where I have directly made connections with community and in the hopes of ensuring in good faith that they will receive resources and funding and opportunities, only to really not be able to pay them in real time or at all, or fulfill any of the ideas or conversations or plans. And so it has been the most heart-wrenching and devastating couple of months in my entire life in terms of community work and community organizing. Never before has it been harder.
Yeah, I would just reiterate, very similar feelings. I think, I mean, I obviously wasn't receiving as much of the brunt of it as Amber, but I think even in me, like stepping up just to be like the only person being like, maybe we should be listening to Amber and supporting her, and like her and I are like actually trying to do this thing, like it got me like shut out too, and like just getting the same type of behavior. It was just this like, it was so bizarre, and like, yeah, it was really hard. It was hard watching, and I don't want to speak for Amber, but it was hard watching multiple calls with on Zoom with these people from Neighborhood House, from OPEC, from OSU, from all of these ones, and have Amber like breaking down, like crying for how hard it is, and them just being like multiple times, like literally begging for help, begging for support, for some reprieve, and people like with all the power and all, holding all the purse strings, just being like, it's too bad for you. Like literally because verbatim.
We were the only ones who had read the 36-page OSU OPEC approved hub guidebook on how to build these parenting programs. And we were in weekly conversations with OSU professors who directly chose Neighborhood House to be holding the funds and distributing the funds into the community. And so we had gone to, as far as we had known, we had gone to the highest people who could support us and making sure that we were following every step and rule that had been put in place to build a successful hub, because hubs have been built for decades all around Oregon, except for in Multnomah County. And so we just kept hitting obstacle after obstacle after obstacle to no avail, with no explanation and no level of support, asked to build programs that we couldn't support. And then Zach and I are in one OSU meeting where a quarterly report had been submitted, and language that Zach and I have used in emails was put into this reporting as if we had been doing this work. And at that point, it was really clear that it was just smoke and mirrors and a facade. And I was so disheartened to see my name next to work that I had tried to do, that I was not allowed to do, that had been reported to funders as if they had done it, which again speaks to this larger experience of Neighborhood House having mismanaged funds for 3 years with zero deliverables before Zach and I became employees and contracted and actually had deliverables.
Yeah, so as moving forward, one, I guess, what are the next steps as far as, you know, action with Neighborhood House, both from a, obviously, for your situation, but I think also, yeah, because we're talking about a larger issue with nonprofits in general in Oregon specifically. Like this might seem like a little bit of a ridiculous ask here, but is there anything Neighborhood House can actually do to repair this situation at this point?
I mean, at this point, we both got let go at the end of March. I was a contractor, so they were just like, we're done with your services. And then Amber got fired for made up reasons. And we then spent all of this past month in April working for free to get things paid from an event we did in February for Black History Month, as well as a whole series that we did and executed through March, which is still ongoing, that they just decided they didn't need to pay anyone for. And actually we paid for a lot of it out of our own pockets, like not even Amber's org, like her and I personally paying out of our pockets to pay for these events that Neighborhood House literally used photos of in a donor meeting with OSU and with Oregon Community Foundation. And they all knew about all of this and did and said nothing. And then we had to go and work 27 days, day and night, over weekends, during the month. Neither of us are getting paid just to make sure they fulfill these commitments. And it was just, I mean, we are both like, our brains are so broken, like trying to have like, be like, what is even like happening here? It was so much gaslighting. It was so much disrespect. And at the end it was like, yeah, like, I feel like we lost pieces of our humanity, just like literally begging to get invoices paid. Cause Amber had community asking very often about when to get paid, and rightfully so, like it should also not have to be us dictating it because we were no longer working there, but we were also stuck in this corner where like I would never have put any Black community members in contact with any of these people. We've seen how they treated Amber. We've seen how they treated other people. I was like, I would not put them in contact with them directly. But so we're stuck in this middle point of like having to solve this problem we didn't even create and are actually suffering from, and just like begging all these people in power with all the resources to help and do something. And it literally took until like last week to get it wrapped up.
I mean, really today, I mean, or yesterday, like one of the people just got paid yesterday, one of the Black community members. And I would say it's radicalizing on a few levels, the ways in which white people with access to funds, philanthropists, large organizations, county orgs, how they really, really just keep funding and resources within a small group of their own peers. And it was radicalizing to watch that happen in real time, just the gatekeeping that took place to even accessing just what would be like a grain of sand in their large sand bucket. And it was radicalizing watching Zach essentially say things that I had said or say in different ways and get listened to. It was like degrees of colorism taking place, Bruce. And it is continuously radicalizing as I receive messages from Joy Elise from Imagine Black, where OCF's equity employee, I don't even know who
equity
they are.
VP, equity and culture VP, her name is Marcy
Equity and culture
Bradley.
VP, are reaching out to them without ever reaching out to me after multiple attempts, both calling and emailing relentlessly for support and information and transparency to find out if I would have to pay as an individual again for work that was started under Neighborhood House, a series that we began, culturally specific series with 44 families. It is radicalizing me still that Imagine Black, an organization that I tried to have Neighborhood House partner with, is receiving direct communication from OCF to confirm that I was trying to build a relationship with them, although they have yet to even circle back and try to connect with me at all about anything that's taken place. So it is this insidious web that these white people are playing at this high level, and they get a few Black tokens who are just uphold the system. And it's everything we know, Bruce, it's everything we know, but it is money in the tune of billions. And, you know, Zach and I were just trying to circulate thousands. I'm thankful for the lessons, and hopefully never again. And I'm deeply, deeply saddened. And just hope to be able to repair on my end, my name with the community.
Yeah, just to reiterate the point too of like, there's so much many resources out there, and there's so much that says it's earmarked for like BIPOC communities and all these things. And like, we're literally trying to give out like, for example, like these mini grants for like 30K, if that even. And we're like, this would be game changer for like a small org, right? Like small orgs that are like fund themselves or whatever. And instead, all these like foundations and big orgs are like, well, let's just give it to these other big orgs who also already have millions of dollars. So you see this like shuffling of money into these like really performative tokenized groups. Like, I don't want to like name them specifically, but everyone probably knows them. It's like there's one token for each racial group, and that's who gets like pulled out of the woodwork every time there's a kind of diversity discussion.
We shouldn't have to beg for small orgs to get funding when OSU started SEI, and you want to already just give mini grants to SEI. Like, great. And you also have to should be supporting as part of your value system and praxis and your equity statements, other orgs and communities that are doing work in similar or different spaces with and for the people.
And who don't have $15 million every year already.
We're saying both and.
Yeah, well, Amber, Zach, thank you again for taking the time today. I know it's not easy kind of recalling all these issues and kind of just, you know, answering questions about this. But I really appreciate your time and candidness. And you know, hopefully nothing else is can be instructive for people, because I think we really kind of like take for granted that people just get how these, like how these systems of power work and all the stuff that goes behind the scenes. Like you said earlier, a lot of times you all become the faces of it. People don't see, you know, if they see Neighborhood House on the name, they might see it, but they don't see those faces. They don't see the people, the big funders and all that. And well, it's just a lot of stuff, both I think obvious to people and not so obvious to people, you know, in terms of like the consequences that come with that. So again, thank you all for taking the time this morning. And, you know, just, you know, honestly, just hope for the best.
Thanks for validating and holding space for us, Bruce, and just sharing your energy. Always value you.
Yeah, thank you a lot. I think it's been hard. Like, we've really had no one actually like listen and have the questions kind of that you've had that are so insightful and kind of like digging to the root of the issues. And I even think just like calling out the nonprofit industrial complex, like it gets called out on like the right and the left on every other thing. But I think the bigger piece of it is just like, ask more questions, look into where money's coming from, look into where it's going, ask if these types of services and resources are better served going into these unchecked private donors deciding what communities need versus like social services. It's just like such a mess, clusterfuck, whatever.
I'd say keep your receipts, like
always.
Always keep your receipts, especially working with white people. Thanks, Bruce.
This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Again, you can catch us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7, or you can catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. If you want access to exclusive bonus coverage, you can go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. And make sure to follow us on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM. That's numbers with a Z. Or on the Numbers Podcast Network on all podcasting platforms, or thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a C.